Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Lumen Industries Radio, which is actually turned into Mangum Talks TV. So we're going to cross-post this on Lumen Industries Radio and Mangum Talks TV. If you are listening on Lumen Industries Radio, if that's the podcast feed that you are subscribed to, please go over, subscribe to Mangum Talks TV. We have consolidated all of our podcasts, all of our television reviews onto the Mangum Talks TV podcast feed. We are back. We're back, Spencer. We have taken a break from our TV reviews. I think the last TV show that we reviewed was season 2 of House of the Dragon, which was a bit of a disappointment. We've taken about 4 months off. We are back to review season 2 of Severance. How you doing?
I cannot tell you how excited I am. This show, which I credit you with making me watch it, was my biggest surprise when it came out. Was it 3 years ago now? Has it been that long? It feels like it was a prior age. But I adored it when it came out. It was one of the few shows that legitimately surprised me and kept me excited week to week and watching it. And so waiting for the buildup of when this season would come, and then the pondering of whether you and I would be talking about it on a podcast form, I am really excited to be here.
I am too. We weren't planning to cover this, so we're a little late in getting our coverage out. I said I was doing too many podcasts. If you follow Mangum Talks TV, I was doing Star Trek, I was doing Star Wars, I was doing Wheel of Time, I was doing this one. I was just doing too many podcasts. I had a job that required a lot of travel. So I knocked all the podcasts out. I reset some things for me. I switched jobs. I don't travel as much. The stress, Spencer, much lower from your guy, Lee. Much lower stress. And that means I've got a little time to come back, a better me, as they say. Being the best version of myself on the podcast so that I can actually enjoy it, right? Like if I'm coming to the podcast and it's work and it's not enjoyable, you will hear that from me. I'm convinced that you'll hear it in my voice. It won't be as fun to listen to. So I took some time to make sure that when we do the podcast, they're actually fun, right? So that I'm having a good time, you're having a good time, Spencer, and the people listening hopefully are getting that vibe.
I feel like it just says something fundamental about us, that you have spent the last 6 months looking to actively improve your life, change your career, take genuine beneficial steps to improve the average quality of your day and your future prospects. Yep. I've done nothing, but I'm here for a podcast.
Yeah, Spencer hasn't done all of that stuff. So what all that stuff I just said, Spencer's somehow done none of it. But he is excited to be back. I have to give you a lot of credit. When I said I was done and needed a break, you didn't take it personally. You said, okay, good, do what you need to do. And then when I said, I'm ready to come back, you said, let's do it. So that's a fantastic podcast partner. I appreciate that in you. So thanks everybody for giving us some time. We are back. We're going to review Severance season 2. Because we're a little late, we're going to review episode 1 and 2 in this podcast episode. So if you have not watched through Severance season 2, episode 1 and 2, then you want to pause now and come back when you finished episode 2. Because we're not going to do any break, right? It's just going to be a full, free-flowing discussion about both episodes. So that's what we're covering here today. And we're going to have a little bit of a different format than we typically have had on our TV review podcast on Mangum Talks. So we are not going to do a long, detailed, line-by-line recap. Instead, we are going to assume you watch the episode, that you know the major plot points, and we're just going to talk through how we feel about it, what we think. Spencer's got some really fun, I think, ideas, topics for us, some bits, as it were, and we're gonna go through that. So let's start right now, because we don't have anything to plug, because I'm not doing another podcast. Let's start right now with just how you felt about the first two episodes, considering the break, considering the expectations. Where's your head at on Severance season 2?
Looking at both episodes combined, a damn near perfect reintroduction to the series. I thought they were excellent counterpoints to each other. I like that they, since they were able to look at basically the same time period now that we know, the same time period from different perspectives, we got to address theories within each one, because each side doesn't have the same complete knowledge that we do of what's going on. I thought the characters were on point. I thought the story was moving very well. I thought the opportunities for theory crafting and conspiracy theories were through the roof. I mean, as you well know about me, I'm practically anti-conspiracy theorist in my own private life, but when it comes to this show, I'm pondering moon landings within the relative terms of the show's context. I had an absolute blast with this, getting back into this show. I thought it was hitting damn near the highest points of season one at the beginning of season two. And if that's where we're starting, I can't express how excited I'm going to be as the show goes on.
Yeah, you know, I think I'm with you. What, you know, as much as we love the Westeros world, right? And I really do. I feel like the books that George R. R. Martin produced have become now underrated because people have had this big backlash against the world of Westeros because he hasn't written more because the TV shows have disappointed. And we like the world of Westeros because of that really good writing from Martin, right?
Mm-hmm.
I want our television shows to have great writing. And I feel like that's a great example, the Westeros shows, of the adaptation or the television show being more worried about the visual aspect, the production aspect, than the sitting down pen to paper and writing. I bring all that up because I understand that this season had multiple rewrites and delays from writing. So they were ready for production and said, we have to stop. We need to write more, which is fantastic, right? I love to hear that they're prioritizing, look, the story's not where we want it to be. It doesn't matter that we've got the actors ready to go. Doesn't matter that we've got all the equipment ready to go. We've got to sit down and make this story better. That's what I want out of these shows. And it does feel like they've done that. Now, it could go off the rails. We may not like the end of season two, but the first two episodes, I do feel like have been carefully written. And that's really what I'm hoping to see more in television shows. I've backed off a lot of the TV I'm watching because I feel like so much of it has been, and it's my intake, but so much of what I've been seeing in the last 4 or 5 years has been so hyper-focused on production, big visual elements, and the storytelling has suffered. And we've covered a lot of that on this podcast network of inconsistencies in television shows, things that don't make sense. Oh yeah, that's beautiful, but why did so-and-so do this? That doesn't make any sense to me. This show doesn't seem to be in that lens. It seems to prioritize the writing and then they do the production on the back of it.
I'm right there with you. I mean, I don't necessarily need much in terms of pomp and circumstance to be entertained. Like you said, we've gotten to media through reading books. It's what we best enjoy. And a show that has quality writing is always going to stand out to me over a show that has invested $10 million into all kinds of exciting events. Spectacle, thank you. That was word was defying me. Over every single minute that it's on the screen. I say that, though, acknowledging that the opening few minutes of the first episode were some of the more interesting spectacle they've yet done on this series in terms of that filmmaking of the hallway, which, as you said, was so effective that it sent you, who suffers from motion sickness, down into an outright spiral.
Got me sick. I turned my head as if I was on a roller coaster. It was... Yeah. They can produce a good visual television show, right? It's artistic in the way that they think about camera angles, who they're focusing on within the context of the storytelling. The lighting is important for the mood of the scene they're trying to convey. They do that stuff. I'm not saying that stuff isn't important, but I am saying for me, it is less important than a good story. That's why, like, if I'm struggling to find something on television, I have no problem going back to like a movie from 58, right? And watching it, even though I know that I'm going to watch something that is way, way diminished, way less on the production side because it's good writing. So I always want to prioritize the writing. Writing so far has been really good. It seems like what they were going for in these two episodes was episode one, they give us the immediate aftermath of the events of the finale of season one from Mark's perspective. So we get Mark's perspective on the events, the immediate aftermath of the events of the finale of season one. And then they cut to, well, what was it for everybody else? And that was kind of what we got in episode two.
And much more immediate than they were even originally trying to tell us. Mr. Milchick lied to us, as we now know in episode two, that was there any doubt? You and I talked on the phone shortly afterwards that we don't trust Lumen as far as we can throw them when it comes to anything that they tell us. But even within the first episode, the whole claims of 5 months and the new, the campaign to provide greater rights for innies, all of that is proven to be absolutely bunk, as we find out in episode two, what, 3 days, 4 days has passed over the course of the entire period that we saw in episode one? Which, you who does work in government and business contracting, credit to Lumen contractors for how quick they can get, you know, a project in place and actually up and functioning. I've never met a contractor who's able to pull off what they did in 3 days, but somehow they made it work.
Yeah, you know, that was one of the things that made me realize we needed to keep doing the podcast is because you know, I communicated to you, we're not going to do the podcast. I need, you know, this break. And I made this progress, right? I'd switched careers. I wasn't traveling as much. I was in a much better space. I mean, when you talked to me the last few months, you probably can notice it.
No,
much better space. No, yeah. And then you were like, can we just talk on the phone if we're not going to do a podcast? I really want to talk about severance. And I was like, of course. Yeah, absolutely. And I got excited. And then I was like, well, wait a second. If we're talking on the phone, we might as well just record the thing. So we did chat after episode one when we hadn't seen episode two. And you asked me pointedly, you said, do you believe that it's really been 5 months? And me being the corporate shill, the status quo Lee, as they call me, I said, yeah, of course, it makes perfect sense that it would have been 5 months. I mean, they're not going to bring any Mark back immediately. And then what do we see in episode two? That is exactly what they did. They brought him back next day. It seems like, and then 3 days pass before he, you know, makes his move, yells at the board, and changes the chess pieces on the board.
Now, in fairness, we don't exactly know what the gap is between Mark coming back for the next day, whatever else, and then bringing back his coworkers. But even then, with an episode two, it still seems like that was only over no more than a week period it took to bring back the other people.
It felt like the next day, right? Because he says, maybe I'm wrong, but Milchick says, I'll see you tomorrow. And Mark's like, I don't know. And then he gives him the guilt trip, and then Mark kind of reassesses.
Well, Mark coming back, yes. Then we've got that interlude where they brought in the three other people, which apparently they do have overseas offices and can bring in Italian temps. But then them getting fired and then bringing in the other new people, it still suggested that's 3 days, because Mark sees that one guy leaving, being fired, having said, you only brought me back for 3 days. Notably,
can I add a piece of data element to that? Is we get the sort of sped up check in, check out scenes from Mark, and if you count them, it's 3 days.
Yes, very true. We also get from that guy a final indication of where we might be located, because that's always been somewhat ambiguous, of where he says he got a lease in Grand Rapids, so we may be in Michigan. Don't necessarily know that he got a lease in the same state of where he lives, but most likely that's the case. So maybe we're situated in Michigan. Whole Detroit connections. Collapse the American industry, a whole other things we can go into for theory crafting there. But yeah, the idea that you and I were struggling with that, but hey, I wonder if this is, we think that they're lying, but how could they get all this done? Lumen has apparently enough reach that they can hire Keanu Reeves to narrate a puppet video that they're able to put together in 3 days to bring back people to convince them that they've successfully reformed the company. This company has draw. Did you recognize Keanu Reeves' voice, by the way?
I did. That had to be like a Ben Stiller special, right? Ben Stiller had to make that happen.
Called a buddy. So we can go straight into some theories or some ponderings or some key moments if you like, but otherwise I think we're just going to gush about the episode for the next 30 minutes or however long we talk.
I do want to say that I liked episode two better than episode one. Not that episode one was bad, but episode two was riveting to me. And I also am not remotely surprised that it's in Michigan. It looks like Michigan, if you've ever been. The Michigan sky. People who've been to Michigan don't want to talk about the gray Michigan sky. That's what we're getting in the back of Lumen. I always sort of envisioned it in the American Midwest, and lo and behold, I think that's probably where we are. I liked episode two slightly better than episode one. It's like a difference for me between like a 9.5 and maybe like a 10 or a 9 and a 9.5. I mean, very high scores. But episode two started to build out the character that I'm most excited to learn about and follow this season, which is Helly.
Ooh.
The scene, Helena, I'm going to do Helly is the innie, mm-hmm. Helena is the outside.
100%.
Seeing Helena and her immediate reaction to everything, I have like 75 theories related to Helena and what's going on there. Built on the back of some of the conversations we've had, but also going further than that, I find that to be the most interesting. Like this idea that she's now participated as an innie and truly was an innie. They were playing around. I mean, they did sever her to do this.
Mm-hmm.
She was an innie, and now she has done this thing that is like the worst, like the poison pill of the industry that you can do, which is to call a spade and say, hey, this is actually ethically and morally objectionable, mm-hmm. against her own will. She didn't mean to do it. Her father's upset with her. She now sees that her innie is kissing Mark, and that elicited a very interesting reaction from her, which we'll talk about. And then she's also trying to do all of this cleanup. And then Helly or Helena, someone goes back into Lumen that we see from the events of episode one. all of that together, my God, what an interesting character landscape they've given this one.
Let's focus on them to start then. In terms of theory crafting that we had after episode one going into episode two, something that you and I had debated is, in all of episode one, did we ever actually see Helly? Was the Innie ever present? And I think you and I expressed no small amount of doubt that Innie Helly had ever actually showed up on screen, and that actually we were seeing Helena occupying all the time and trying to pretend to be Innie Helly for the purpose of confusing and distracting and serving as a spy among the other Innies. Yeah. Going through episode two, is this still a theory that you think has some legs?
Probably more so after the events of episode two. But in episode one, I mean, you had a lot of stuff. When she gets off the elevator, she's having a sort of, it looks like a sort of planned reaction, the sort of trip
generic,
out of the elevator.
Out of breath.
When Mark hugs her, she has a weird reaction before she recognizes. It's almost like her brain was going, oh, what is this? Oh yeah, I'm supposed to hug him. And then she does it. The fact that Helly requires almost no arm twisting to stay is stunning, considering the Helly that we saw in season one. She's also much more subdued. She's fact-finding more. She's asking more questions. One of the few details that she does offer up is about the security camera. Oh, what happened to the security camera? You pointed out that she was having trouble turning the computer off. There was a number of little nuggets through episode one that gave us the idea that this was probably Helena. And then the reaction of Helena in
to the kiss.
Episode two almost proves it more to me, because my big thing was, okay, if this is Helena come back, then what were the events that got her to even agree to participate, right? Why does she find this important? Because she was very dismissive about the entire process, etc. And I think we got two pieces of that in episode two, right? We got episode cold something,
Cold Harbor.
Operation Cold Harbor. And then we got her watching Innie Helly kiss Mark. Mm-hmm. I think both of those things could potentially be explanations for why she agreed to go back in, probably as Helena, but more so why she signed off on this plan to give Mark his people back. Because ultimately she's having to sign off on this plan, right? When Mark yells at the board and says, I want my people back, that's not happening unless she says, yes, let's do it. So we got two potential explanations for why this is occurring.
It's interesting too. I thought that episode two confirmed something that I wasn't really certain about, is that how powerful Helena is in the company. Of where I had kind of imagined in season one that, okay, well, she's a member of the family, maybe she's some kind of junior executive, maybe this is her trying to make, you know, do a personal act so that she gets greater notice within the family and rises through the ranks. It kind of screamed like junior executive trying to buck for a promotion kind of thing, doing an off-the-wall thing so as to, you know, show their dedication. What episode two shows is that, no, this is her baby. This is her project. She has a remarkable amount of pull. She is some senior member of the company, possibly only secondary to her father, who, as in terms of another motivation, she seems to have lost the certain measure of trust for, trust of, and maybe never had much affection with, when his only action we see from this episode is to look at her with just profound disgust and refer to her as, I believe the term was, a fetid moppet, which is a perfectly legitimate English phrase which has not been used in over 100 years. Further questions about the Egan family. But
yeah, less. She's less Roman Roy, maybe more Ivanka Trump, right? She's more ruling with, as opposed to sort of fumbling dolt, you know, non-heir.
So, what do you make of her reaction when she watched that video of her Innie kissing Innie Mark? Of she stopped it. She took breath. She went back and she replayed it. And the camera spent all of its time just focusing on her dilating pupil as she watched that occur. What are we meant to make out of how she processed watching those events take place?
Okay, so this is the big, big thing I want to talk about this episode. I think there is multiple paths for this reaction. There are multiple ways to explain it that we will get. The first, which is probably what most people are assuming, and it's maybe the most likely, I don't know, at least it's more basic storytelling, is that she's thinking, I can use this. I can use this to manipulate Mark to continue Operation Cold Harbor, to make sure he does whatever he needs to do to make sure that this is successful.
Definitely possible.
I now have a tool in a toolbox. What I suspect is happening is that the character of Helena is lonely billionaire, lonely executive, works all the time, after father's approval, no real social life, etc. And the romantic interest in any Mark is going to blend between Helena and Helly.
I'm so glad you focused on that, Ben, because that's where that's straight where I am. I think everyone's agreeing that she was intrigued by what she saw, but some people are seeing it as professionally intrigued. I'm with you. I saw it as personally intrigued. I saw it as, this is foreign to me. This is an opportunity of relationships or caring or whatever else that I haven't gotten to experience due to either family stifling or career dedication or whatever else. That seemed like a person of, she was legitimately caught off guard and then kind of personally captivated and motivated in a way she didn't expect of herself.
It's going to, if that is the way that they're going, and I think that it is, that, so here's something. When Mark yells into the intercom, I want my people back, it seems a little easy that he got his people back so quickly, doesn't it? It seems like that happened faster than we thought, with less effort from Mark than we thought might be required. The explanation we get in the boardroom is, well, he won't finish Cold Harbor unless we do this. We have to do it. I feel like that's a stretch based on the fact that he locked one door and yelled in a microphone. Like, I mean, you know, like he hasn't with the new, they did not give the new crew sufficient time to see if that would actually work with
a day, basically. Yeah.
It seems like as soon as Helena saw that Helly kissed any Mark, that is when the decision was made. It was a little bit less about Mark yelling in a microphone and undermining Milchick, which he does every 12 seconds anyway. And it was more about Helena saying, I want to go meet this guy.
I think it's very possible. It's going to cut to the other theory about the importance of Mark here in a second. One other bit of evidence I wanted to note as well. I thought we got another independent bit of evidence in episode 2 that it is Audi Helly that is operating on the Severance floor. And it's an audio clue this time. You said we went through a scene of where we got to see Mark go down the elevator. We got to see Dylan go down the elevator. We got to see Irving go down the elevator. And then Helena shows up after all of them. And with every one of the ones that went down first, there is a ding when the elevator comes to the top, and there is a ding when the elevator goes down. Happened with every one of them. They wanted us to see the process of that. When Helena arrives to go in the elevator, there is a ding when the elevator comes up, and there is silence as the elevator goes down.
Yep.
The show is too carefully crafted for that not to be relevant in my mind. So at this point, I'm of the view that unless they give me strong evidence otherwise, I'm pretty convinced this is no longer a conspiracy theory. This is just a very clever plot direction for the overall season. And if it ties in, as you said, the idea that Helena is personally pushing having the opportunity to have a connection with any Mark for whatever reason, professional or personal, that's going to be fascinating to watch unfold. And I don't think the show's necessarily trying to hide it. I think they're just not explicitly saying it. But we'll see where that goes. But you set up another one of the things I want to talk about too, of where Mark appears to be everything for this Severance group in a way that wasn't previously clear. We knew that he was in some way the golden boy. They gave him, what was it, a crystal of his own face or something that he had on his desk that they gave as a personal gift to him.
Yeah, that's right. One of those little things you get like in a mall kiosk.
Yeah, exactly, one of those. While everybody else was fighting over finger traps, he got that own personal thing, which Dylan seemed not even a little bit, not more than a little bit bitter about.
Not fair at all.
This episode we get seen that they don't see a point in anything continuing unless Mark is present. Well, why they chose to go the route that they did, who can say? But it seems beyond dispute that Mark is the project. Mark is necessary for whatever they want Cold Harbor to occur, to happen. They need him to be there for it. And since we know Cold Harbor is in some way connected to Miss Casey and Gemma, however we want to choose to refer to her, I have to feel that those two are going hand in hand to some point. Do we have enough at this point to even speculate or theorycraft as to why he's necessary to the project beyond simply that his ex-wife is in ex-wife, deceased wife, whatever state of wife she is in some way tied to it. Do we know what that means? I offer it to you, sir. Theory craft with me.
I think sometimes my theory crafting starts to get into fan fiction. I just start writing the show for him.
Go.
So if I'm doing that, I apologize and call me out for it, because I'm trying to stick to what they've shown me. Yes, Mark is clearly the most important piece of it. I think that Miss, our guy call her? Kolbelvig?
Yeah, Kolbelvig. Kolbelvig. Yes.
Might be a useful term.
Done.
Kolbelvig, this focusing on him, I don't think was erotic. I don't think that she's crazy.
There wasn't a throuple in the works.
I don't think there was no throuple going on. I think that he is that important, and she took it upon herself to do some personal oversight mm-hmm. of him. And the fact that she needed to oversee Audi Mark gives us a clue about what they're actually testing, what is actually important in this. And I think it's Mark's grief. I mean, I think they've manufactured grief. Obviously, his wife isn't dead. They gave him a different burned body. We learned in the conversation at the diner, which I have a whole nother rant on Audi Mark about, come on, Audi Mark, you're not the only person who misses her. The discussion did tell us that the body was heavily burned, and the idea that he could have seen a body that was not his wife is very much in play. I think they've manufactured grief to test grief for this person. And I think that is what that's why Audi Mark is important to the equation. If it was just testing, okay, you sever somebody, and then what do they know? What don't they know? How productive can they be? What can they do? All that testing is the innie. But instead, Miss Kolbelvig needed mm-hmm. to be right next to Audi Mark, see him daily, talk to him, give him bad cookies. So I think that's a clue that they're testing grief, and it's likely some sort of commercialized product. I'm going to guess with this world, as cynical as this show is, it's some sort of get over your grief with Lumen. Like, have you lost somebody close to you? Well, let Lumen take that burden from you. Let us help you out by severing you.
I like how you hit a point that's very near and dear to my heart. Bad cookies are a gateway to grief. Bad cookies can just ruin your day in a way that good cookies can otherwise set it off the charts. I'm with you. I'm gonna put a different perspective on it, or a different theory crafting, just to be contrary. I think it has something to do with memory. The fact that we know from what we saw, in that little flash in episode one, seems to be something of what they're doing with moving the numbers around the screen is affecting. How do we refer to her? Miss Casey or Gimmick at this point? It's one and the same person, basically. Kind of. Maybe. It's mushy. I'll say Miss Casey.
Gimacy might be a useful phrase.
Gimacy is done. Thank you, Rickon. It looked like that when he was moving the numbers into the little percentages, it was in some way affecting Miss Gimacy. I wonder to what degree that he's severed, but it's still him, and he still has the same memories. To what degree the numbers they're actually working on are in some way connected to prior experiences of her, prior memories of her, life lived with her, that he's able to edit, box, either remove, enhance, change, distribute to some other purpose or use, to move into other people by means of those little severance things or whatever else. I'm wondering to what degree it's some degree of memory or personality editing based on the fact that he had an actual connection with Gimacy in a way that no one else had. And I'm curious to see whether it could be something going in that regard. It may also tie into a certain degree of...
So he's programming her memory, is what you're saying?
He's either programming, or he's editing, or he is modifying, or he's packaging and redistributing to use, like, look at it this way, boy. Kind of thing. Like, if there's a memory of her on a sunny day, he's cutting that out, he's putting it in a little box, and they're sending that off to sell it and put into somebody else by means of a little thing they put in their heads, kind of thing.
Maybe Star Trek in your life.
Star Trek in my life. Or maybe it's rebuilding her memory to suit their purposes as some kind of reprogramming. I don't know, but I think that could be something interesting along those lines. And if, I think this is a fool's errand, but if we want to believe Lumen for a second, that Miss Kolbelvig was going off the reservation to a certain degree and doing her own projects, which I think she was to at least some degree based on Mr. Milchick's consistently surprised reaction to her. One of the things that we saw in her little shrine and things that she was holding and focusing on was a medical bracelet. which wasn't of her. I think you and I pondered at the time, maybe it was her mom or something along those lines. What if her own personal commitment to this is that she has someone in her life that was either injured or lost their memory or otherwise is in a coma kind of state? And so seeing someone who is severed but is able to edit and move around or recognize memories and possibly use them to bring back or reprogram or bring back to life someone that was prior near and dear to him, maybe it's something that she would be personally invested in, so much so that she's wanting to test and check and go through details along those ways with respect to him, or even see whether the two of them can recognize each other despite the fact that they've been severed, which could be something that would be very important to her if she's dealing with someone who's in the similar kind of patient dementia or whatever else kind of state. Maybe it's tying into that degree, but that's kind of, between that and the what we saw of Gumaesi, I'm thinking it's some kind of memory or personality or editing of consciousness kind of focused. And that's why they need him, because he's the only one who had that kind of actual connection to Gumaesi, the deceased, however we wish to refer to her, that no one else would be in position to do.
So the counter there is that it does seem like moving the numbers and recognizing something in the numbers, having an emotional feeling from the numbers, is happening with the other three as well. It doesn't seem like it's just Mark that's having that reaction to them.
It is. I wonder to what degree they're just to control. I wonder to what degree that they are playing a relevant role. I wonder what degree they're working on other people. All I know from this episode, though, is that, yes, they were doing it. Yes, they were having an emotional reaction, but Lumen gave two shits about whether they were there or not, which raises questions about to what degree they were actually important or not.
Yeah, I find that to be busy work, but I certainly would not be upset with if it played out the way that you're discussing. But I just sort of assumed in my theory crafting that was more busy work for them, and what they're testing is if Mark, they can't take this to market and say, you want to forget about your loved one? Here's a way to do it. You'll never have to have the pain of grief again if there is an opportunity for that person to remember. So they're testing it at the highest degree. Like they are trial by fire for any Mark. Like I'm going to
putting him through fire.
Miss Casey there and see if it sparks a memory. And if it doesn't spark a memory, then we can. It's basically like a drug trial. And my ultimate theory here is that this is going to result in this is going to result in either Helena or outing Mark, making the bid that any Mark exists 100% of the time. That's going to be something that is pushed by Audi Mark or potentially Helena, that any Mark exists 100% of the time, which is the ultimate goal, I think, of this grief quote therapy, this grief treatment that they're coming up with, which is just to forget that you ever loved the person to begin with.
Well, that's tragic and nightmarish in all kinds of fun ways.
Yeah, that's my guess here. But I don't know. Do you have any other things you want to get to? What other things you have on your list today?
Well, I got two to jump off from, and I'll let you pick which one we want to go into next. Given the focus on Mark and Gumaesi, do we want to talk about Miss Wang? It's possibility number one. Or possibly number two, you already referenced it, but do we want to give Audi Mark a bit of our minds in terms of how he's treating those around him, both in season one that we've seen, but also particularly in the last episode? Which would you like to do first?
I want to go to Miss Wang after I say something for 30 seconds.
45 Please.
Seconds, probably, knowing me.
40 seconds.
I just want to give a shout out to the show for doing a beautiful mid-episode interlude to suicide, basically, to our guy Totoro's character wanting, in effect, to kill himself by leaving, right? That is what we've established happens with the innies. When the innies leave and they're just the outie, they cease to exist. He was going to do that. He was going to leave and never come back. Innie Dylan stood in the doorway and said, you can't do this because it would hurt me. And that, I felt like they were talking about suicide. I felt like that was what the discussion was. And it was just a 5-minute thing in the middle of this episode, a metaphor for when somebody wants to exit stage left, how loved ones react and talk to that person in effective ways, which is, you can't do this because I need you here. it will hurt me. I'm better with you. That's what Dylan said. I'm better at whatever I do here, whatever small thing in my world, right? And you can extrapolate that. We're all doing small things, right? In the world. These small things that I do are better with you in it. You can't leave. They were very physical. They were touching each other's faces. They were getting very close to each other. And I think it was just this somebody in the writing and production crew said, I know we got all this other stuff going on in the story, but we're going to do this like little moment to show like fighting for somebody else's life. It was beautiful. I thought it was really well done.
In a well-written episode of some wonderful bits of dialogue, some proper comedy, some proper drama, some wonderful conspiracy-causing moments, that was my line and scene of the episode. I adored every aspect of that. It was beautifully written. It was wonderfully acted. It was emotionally on point. That was my top moment of episode one.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Dylan saying, I teared up twice. I watched it, but when he says, whatever it is I do here, whatever this thing is, I do it better because you're here. I will be sad if you go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, go has bigger meaning for these people. You can't just go and come back. You go and you cease to exist. And it worked, right? When Dylan left that hallway, when he was called back from Miss Wang, who's the authority figure, he was very much unsure that his friend was going to come back, and then he did. And I think it's that what we're meant to believe is that it's directly because of Dylan's influence that Totoro's character. What is that guy's name? Totoro's character.
Irv.
Irv is able to put those feelings aside for a moment and keep putting one foot in front of the other. Right. I think that the belief that what I got from the show is they're trying to tell us that Dylan's interjection there mattered.
I don't think there's any means of disputing that. I think Dylan should have been reassured even in the moment of he so effectively brought Irv out of what he was going through, at least for a second there, that Irv actually chuckled and even responded, Dylan, I'm your favorite perk. It was meeting him at a point, showing a little bit of vulnerability, making it personal in himself, that had just an utterly profound and immediate effect. A wonderfully done scene.
Fantastic. All right, Miss Wang, what the fuck? What is this thing? Is this a MacGuffin in the story?
I don't know. Is it a MacGuffin? Is it a red herring? Is it meant to be just an utter misdirect, just having something weird like the fucking goats in the hallways that we may never come back to or not?
We're never getting explicit goats. I'm just going to tell you right now. There's no way. We're not going back to the goats.
They're not ready. I'm just feeding them milk for no apparent reason. We'll not return to this. It could just be another thing that's weird. It could be something that's proven relevant later, but it's this show. It's got us and everybody else on the internet going tied up into knots, now pondering in a way that literally can't be the case unless there's some other form of advanced technology we've yet seen. And one of the last things I want to talk about is what the level of technology is in this world, whether this is an alternate world or not. But you and I discussed, people have pondered, is she their daughter? Is she a clone? Is she personally connected? Or did they just bring in a person that is, you know, I think the actress was actually like 15 when they filmed it or whatever else, but she looks 12. I don't know.
I don't know that she looks 12, but she does look younger because the actors say that she looks young. Like when I first saw her, I went 15. I could have very easily believed that. But when they kept saying, why is she eight? Why is she eight? By the time of the end of the two episodes, I was like, this is a first grader. This person is so young.
Well, the fact that they've got her as a former crossing guard, the fact that they've got the schoolgirl strap and schoolgirl outfit that she's wearing everywhere else, they're styling her to be younger. I think even by the time that she may have filmed this, she was in her upper teens, whatever else. I also looked her up. She was born in Raleigh, so proper North Carolinian joining the show.
Look at that. Probably knows good barbecue.
Indeed. But I don't think we know anywhere near enough at this point whether she is relevant to the overall story or not, other than that she is sitting in as Mr. Milchick, or as the Mr. Milchick role. I feel like she's severed in a way that Mr. Milchick isn't, which is interesting.
And yeah, I agree with that.
They seem to be wanting to draw parallels between her and Miss Casey in terms of how she experiences the universe, of where most of what she experiences is halting, it is robotic, it is over long stairs. It's like she's working from a very narrow kind of playbook of information that she's drawing from. She is an AI that has very little in the way of algorithms put in place to be able to respond to stimuli. And so that makes for an unsettling kind of experience, but whether it is overall more relevant going forward, I don't know. It was effective, episode one, but I don't know what to make of it and whether it's going to have any long-term role in the overall plot.
We agree. I floated the theory of her being the child of Mark and Miss Casey, that potentially this child also died, although you'd think we would have heard that in some of the conversations, or, you know, Pike potentially is just a clone of Miss Casey and it's still continuing to test Mark's ability to detect these things, or it could just be nothing. I don't know.
I mean, it's one of those things, I mean, you even expressed at the time, the timing wouldn't work for it to be the case unless they've got some way of super aging her. It's only been like 2-3 years since she died. So, but the technology in this show is schizo. This technology in this show is purposefully inconsistent, which tells me that we're in some kind of alternate history, alternate universe kind of thing, of where, like, even within episode two, Mark's got a modern smartphone, but everybody's watching TV on old analog screens. They're using old-fashioned giant recording devices rather than recording on their cell phone. Every car is ancient. Every car that somebody drives is from prior to 1985. Every one of them. It's amazing they found enough of these cars to fill a parking lot in certain of these scenes. Italy is apparently a third-world country where, you know, their severance floors, people have to climb down on a rope based on the one Italian guy they brought into the show. But at the same time, they've got severance. They've got the ability to change somebody's personality or edit memories or everything else along those lines and remote control people. The technology in the show is purposefully wildly inconsistent. So the possibility that they do have the means of cloning and rapidly aging a clone, I can't write off because I don't know what the technology is or isn't in this universe.
Yeah. I don't have much to add to that other than to say that I think we got some hard evidence that it's a parallel sort of existence. And that's the country count, the count of the countries in the video. Yeah. Yeah. So that doesn't align with our world. Right. So those little details, I think, do tell you definitively it's not our world.
You also seemed like you wanted to call out Mark for a little bit for how he was treating his sister. I felt like this was in some way a follow-up for how Mark deals with anyone challenging him on his life choices or what he has done to cope. Because we saw that when he was angrily haranguing those kids or being a unfortunate mess with the respect to, what was her name, Alexa, the midwife that he was dating for a brief period there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that... So there's two things here. One is what I talked about on the podcast when we were reviewing season one, which is I think what they're trying to convey is that Mark going through the severance procedure, basically shutting his brain off for half the day, but really more because he numbs himself with alcohol.
Mm-hmm. He's always
he's not dealing with his grief at all. And so he is still very early in that process. You know, it's been years, but it's been like a couple of weeks in like a normal sort of coping process because he just stopped full progress. Like he just pulled the emergency brake on the grief process. So he's a complete disaster. And I think it can't be the selling, whatever they're doing here can't be, this is a way to cope with grief. Look how well you'll handle grief. We're going to show you Audi Mark. Because Audi Mark is not handling grief well. It's got to be, the sell has to be any Mark. That's what they're selling. It can't be the existence of Audi Mark. Because he is completely miserable because he's never had the opportunity to actually go through a process to move some of these emotions out of his system.
No, his entire life is built around avoidance. And that's the same reaction that we see in this episode. The moment someone confronts him with the possibility of that something that you have now built your life around may not be the case, he immediately reacts aggressively and angrily and starts cutting out one of the few people that he has a loving, supporting relationship with. That is what we see Mark do at every available opportunity, because this is a Mark that is so desperate to avoid pain, he'd rather burn down everything else around him rather than look it in the eye. That is how we have seen him throughout the entirety of the show, and this episode is consistent with that. It is painful to watch. It is real damn unfortunate. It resonates all to hell with me in terms of how I sometimes deal with pain or things I don't want to talk about or confront. So I sympathize with him, but none of it's okay. And I feel like even Mark himself, though, is having to admit that, aspects of it aren't working. But even the end of this episode, his refusal to consider, you know, evidence that is before him can only extend so far when he's confronting Kobelvic in the car and she is practically giving the game away when he's asking her about what is this about Gemma.
Yeah, I mean, Kobelvic does that. That's the sort of like teaser there at the end of episode two, is that she conveys to Audi Mark, yeah, there's something to this, right?
Oh, yeah.
In a way that he wasn't getting from his sister, who it seemed to me that as soon as the sister heard she's alive and him holding the picture, the sister believed that Gemma was probably alive. I mean, she's not let that go. She's holding on to that. But him at the diner, when he's doing the grief comparison with her, is so disappointing. Because
one of the meanest things I've heard somebody say in a long time.
It's really mean, but it's also, you know, Mark, you're missing the point that you really loved this person and you're talking to someone else who did as well. So like you should appreciate, like if you know, you really love Gemma and you're talking to somebody who goes, I'm in pain too because she's gone. That is a thing to love and to like be really pleased to hear that somebody else loved this person too, right? That they saw the value in the person that you miss so dearly. So it's really disappointing. It's also disappointing because it does seem like his sister has a lot going on in her life. She's married to a cult leader. She's got a baby. She's had lactation fraud left and right in her house.
God, yeah.
And she is taking as much time as she can possibly carve out to still try to help her brother, who by all accounts is starting to get in unreasonable territory. Yes, it sucks to lose your spouse. It's terrible. We all sympathize. But there will come a point if you've lost your spouse when you are still drunk all the time and biting everybody's head off and completely unreasonable, when people are going to say it's been too long for this behavior. And Mark is starting to get there in year two, three, right? Maybe not there yet, but we all agree that in year 10, 15, 20, we all go, okay, maybe what I'm seeing here from Audi Mark, you should be past that now, right? He's starting to get to that point, and she's still giving him so much grace.
Yeah.
Like, so this is your one ally. And that's probably one of my favorite character interactions on the show, is Mark and his sister.
Oh, great.
Because the sister really sells to me a well of grace and love for this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like she seems like a smartass and like sort of a pain in the ass most of the time. But when she's talking to her brother, there is this like well of affection that she's drawing on that I sense right away.
It's people having affection for Mark and people also caring about his relationship with Gemesi that made me have greater sympathy for Rickon at the end of last season. When we got to hear him talk about, you know, the hikes that they went on together, how much he was affected when she died, how much, you know, he's been worried or cared about him. It gave me a whole new perspective in the character that, oh, these guys have been friends and cared about each other for decades long before the show. There was a life before this show. And that felt really real. And like you said, the relationship that Mark has with his sister, it's the heart of the damn show for me in terms of their scenes are some of my favorite I see in every episode when they appear.
Love it. So I really enjoy that aspect of the show. Now, I suspect that if we're right, that Helena is in Lumen, in the severed floor now, right?
Yes.
It's not Heli. I suspect Helena and any Mark's interaction is going to maybe supersede it for me. Like that is so, that's a really fascinating line, but Mark and his sister are really, really good. Can we talk a little bit about Dylan can't find work because the severed people are being discriminated against?
Yeah. Let's get into that. That was a fascinating thing to see for each of the characters, why they're on the severed floor, and Dylan in particular, that, you know, he's had a lifetime of part-time jobs. He's got apparently two kids at least. He's got dealing with a baby. He's got a wife that we all look forward to and how supportive she apparently is for him. But the thing that I wasn't expecting he'd have to deal with is now having been fired from the severed job briefly, he's back after 3 days, he immediately goes to look for a new job at it's a door plant? Is he looking to be a door-to-door salesman or make doors? It wasn't clear. A door-to-door door salesman.
I think it's a door-to-door door salesman. Or it's in door production. This is This person really likes doors. I mean, it is a door enthusiast.
100%. To the point they're briefly bonding on the subject of doors and kickball, which is I never thought was a combination before, but I'm here for it. But the moment that he reveals that he is severed, we apparently see the need for a new civil rights act that applies to severed people and treats them as a protected class, because that potential employer shuts down in a heartbeat cuts him off entirely, that we're only looking to hire one person, and frankly, I find what you did abhorrent. Everything else along those lines. I have to believe the show's telling us that this is not a narrowly held belief, that there are a lot of people out there that have this kind of view, and it's going to be interesting now, with apparently maybe a lot of people, more than we know, being severed, how that's going to affect society going forward. We previously saw that there were protest movements, but their idea that there's now this kind of deep-seated intolerance, discrimination, I don't think we had any grounds to know that yet.
Spencer, not in your professional opinion, not as a agent of your employer, but in your personal, as your Audi Spencer.
Yes, go on.
Do you think that simply saying we will fairly consider your resume as you're shepherding somebody out of the door among finding that they have a particular characteristic, do you think that adequately covers you? Because obviously this employer felt like they could say the sentence, because he says it multiple times, we will fairly consider your resume. Somebody told him, or he got it in his head, as long as I say that line, I'm good. Do you think he's good?
I would encourage him that if he feels like that line is the ultimate panacea, make that your last line. Don't say that line and then talk for two more minutes. That's going to be the more comforting element of things.
It's not good. Yeah, we love you, man. This is going to be great. We got health benefits for you. We got coffee in the break room. Oh, you're severed?
Severed.
We will fairly consider your resume.
And oh yeah, I find you personally abhorrent. Yeah, bye.
I'm not sure that just throwing that sentence in covers you for a potential discrimination suit, but I understand that everything is
not a protected class yet. Maybe. I don't know in this universe.
Yeah, we may get there by the season four. All right, what else do you have for us?
A couple other quick things. Irving, like motivation for characters being on the floor. We've talked about Mark. I thought that was a beautiful, horrendous, wonderfully manipulative summary from Mr. Milchick about why Mark is on the floor when it comes to him trying to avoid grief and feeling smothered by the haunting visage ghost of his dead wife. Talk about Dylan desperately trying to find work, trying to support his family. Irving. We had some hints once we got to see a little bit about how Audi Irv lives his life at the end of season one, that this guy's been investigating Severance. He's been investigating Lumen for a while. This episode, last episode, we also got to see that even in his any form, he's got a very analytical mind, that he was the one that focused on the fact of the flaw in Helena's story of a gardener, a night gardener was who you ran to. That obviously didn't make any sense. You don't water at night.
Gardener at night, huh?
Yeah.
But Helena hasn't done a lot of manual labor. She doesn't know.
Even worse, watering or doing gardening work at night in Michigan, what seems to be the perpetual winter that is this show. Absolutely, that's not going to happen.
Come on, Helena.
But now we get to see this episode that he carefully is covering in a way that nobody else is when Mr. Milchick shows up, invents a story despite the fact he seemingly probably just made it back home given the time frame we're seeing fly by. But we also got to see him make a phone call to someone saying, my innie got the message. Don't know who it is. Don't know what the message was. Maybe it was to Bert, because he seemed like he recognized the Bert name and it was written on that pad that was in his pocket. Bert was there also sitting in a car staring at him. Don't know what their role is. Irving is on to something. He is investigating Lumen, maybe seeking to bring Lumen down. His reasons for being on the severed floor are getting all the more interesting by the day.
I'm baffled by Irv. Irv is the one that's confusing me, because I feel like I can craft a sort of narrative about why the other three are in. I can explain why Lumen would put each of the other ones in to this situation. I don't understand Irv. I feel like there's a lot more that we're going to learn. I mean, it looks like what war PTSD. It looks like,
veteran. Yeah.
Dealing with. That through art, Audi is, and then you have at least I don't know if it's repressed or just really sort of desperate romance and sexuality going on with Innie-Bert, all of that tying together, and then the weirdness that is Christopher Walken's character showing up in this episode, because you get the sense at the end of season one that Audi-Bert is not. Doesn't know anything about this, not interested. That has to be Audi Bert there. So why is he interested? So there's so much going on with that character that I don't know. I really don't have many theories about that character. I have a lot of questions and I'm interested. I also have to believe that the people who make this show are too good to cast John Turturro in this role without having somewhere this is going to be important, right? John Turturro is a
wonderful actor.
Probably the most acclaimed actor on the show. He's one of the best in Hollywood. And if you bring that guy in, he works a tight schedule. It's hard to get him on, you know, it delays production trying to get him on the schedule. All this stuff, and Intrigue's expensive. You don't do that unless you got somewhere you're going with this character.
Last thing for me on theory crafting, and then we can go into a few segments that we like to bring into the show. Persephone. That was an interesting word to just throw out there at the beginning of this episode of where Mark's sister, Devin? Is there Devin again? So blanked on that.
I'll look it up.
Asked him, what's my name? And he responded, Persephone. Which seemed to catch her completely off guard. Like, this isn't like a game of they suddenly just turn to Greek mythology when they're talking to each other about each other. It then plays it off as a joke later, but it didn't seem like that was some kind of like pet name that the two of them use. It also would be just a weird pet name, too. Did you look it up?
Yeah, Devon. Devon.
Thank you. I figured that's what it was. It feels really on point for the show. I mean, Persephone being the goddess of the underworld who has to spend half of her time in hell, half of her time in heaven, you know, to use the Christian terms rather than the Greek terms, Hades versus up on Olympus, based on, you know, Hades tricking her to be down there, creating a deal that she has to stay, spend half of her life with him, feels rather on point. It also feels like it'd be on point, too, for the stories of Orpheus and Eurydice, of when he descended into the underworld and had to help persuade Hades and particularly Persephone to help get his wife out of the underworld so that he could return with her to the world of the living. Both of those feel very metaphorically on point when it comes to the show. And I just wonder, is the show just trying to do a wink, wink, nudge, nudge to its overall plot points to the audience? Or is this an indication that the character, despite the fact that he is severed, has a certain common thread that he would even make that kind of reference right now to his sister? I don't know, but it felt very interesting in the moment when that came out.
I had assumed it was some sort of code word between the brother and sister.
But maybe.
When Mark is really upset, needs to get away, needs something, he was trying to communicate to her, like, I got to get out of this situation or whatever it was. That falls apart a tad because she continues to needle him afterwards. Mm-hmm. So she doesn't seem to get that message. But that's what I thought it was. And then I just sort of assumed it was him being silly. And yeah, of course, the writers building in a more fourth wall breaking explanation for why that's there, which you covered well. But I didn't really understand that. I was hoping it was more of a brother sister code language thing because it seems like this is the type of relationship that would have that.
It does. Yeah. I'm curious to go back and rewatch that scene to process her emotions when she first heard it, because it seemed like it surprised her, but I'm 100% there with you. They are the kind of brother-sister that would have pet names for each other, or would just, you know, go into those kind of long-term jokes that they've been riffing on for the last 30 years since they attended the same Greek mythology class together. Very possible.
Okay, so I wasn't saying pet names. That's a weird phrase to use, brother and
very
sister.
Very affectionate. Yes, the two of them.
I was saying it was a code word, like Mark was saying, like when he says Persephone, he's saying, I'm really unhappy. I got to get out of this situation. Can you help me get out of this? Something like that.
We all knew what you were talking about, you Westerosi fan. We understood perfectly. No need to explain it.
That sure does start with a bang, doesn't brother and sister having sex in the window? Quite a start, isn't it? Yeah, it's something else. Okay, what else we got?
If you don't actually have any other theories to offer, shall we discuss maybe who was the employee of the week or weeks when it comes to these two episodes of television?
Yeah. Do we want to... Let's just award one for both weeks since we're covering both in one episode.
I would say that then my employee of the week, I'm going to utterly zag, but I'm going to say my employee of the week would be Helena for the sake of damage control. That... if it was just episode one, I might give a credit to any Mark for rowing, getting what he wants, or any Dylan for just being his most Dylan-y self when it comes to things. Mike gives an honorable mention to Milchick for how well he does in doing damage control throughout the episode, or Devin for just being, just having the patience of Job when it comes to her brother. But Helena? Helena completely gets on a narrative, runs with it, and is able to completely turn the company in a different direction in the course of 3 days from an utterly disastrous series of events that you and I thought might successfully destabilize the overall company. That's just impressive. Much less she decides to be an operative herself again in the field and go down and descend to the Severance floor, the underworld, for the purpose of bringing about her goals. I'm impressed with this woman. She is a manipulative asshole. I was gonna use gender terms, but I won't. But it is consistent. I must be impressed with a villain who is this capable of seeing the board and deciding where the pieces have to go when they're caught this off guard.
Helena is a good one. That's a real good one. I'm going to choose, for a similar reason, right? Leadership. I'm going to choose Innie Dillon. My impression is that Innie Dillon is the leader of this group. He is the one that stayed behind so that they could go out and find out about their Audi selves.
39 minutes. We got it timed out that he held those switches. Give me that man's workout regime.
He's the one who convinced Irv not to leave and cease to exist, right? He's the one that wants to keep tabs on what everybody's doing and cares. You notice, and it was a funny line, but it also was telling, when the claymation, which is like celebrity deathmatch claymation, which I really enjoyed, the claymation Mark and Helly kissed, which, by the way, giving the game away, Lumen, don't put their shit out there like that on the street. When they kissed, Dillon was personally offended that he hadn't been told about this. He turned and looked at him and said, "What the shit?" And I got the impression he was just angry that they had not confided in him that that occurred, right? Not that they were kissing, but that he didn't know. He is constantly like assuming a leadership group of this squad or leadership role of this group. And it's so great, the contrast with the lack of success that Audi Dillon has experienced in his professional life. Like that any Dillon would get there and be the manager, the leader, the person stewarding things, holding things together, literally holding things together. Mm-hmm. And Audi Dillon can't so much as get a job at a door factory. I like that a lot. And that, for that, great storytelling, but also I enjoyed the character. I'm giving it to Innie Dillon. I can also say that Dillon was absolutely on fire with, like, belly laughs these few episodes.
Oh, 100%.
He was crushing it all the way around.
Episode one was the Dillon comedy hour when it comes to every one of his lines about having
Zach Cherry. It's a just wonderful delivery from that actor.
I would say I did not know him before this show, but actually saw him on Succession, I suppose, beforehand. That was the first time I actually saw him. Because he played a minor role in one episode on that, but I liked him there too. He's been great. He was utterly stealing every scene that he was in episode one, and it makes me excited every time I get to see more of him. But as you noted several times, as we've been talking about this, he is the heart in a way that I had not given him enough credit about in season one. That his scene with Irv, he's kind of serving as the background for the resistance in terms of the rallying point, then they all come back around to get everybody back on script and want to be the center of things. It's not just that, you know, he is the go-getter, he's not the most skilled or the most driven, whatever else. He's kind of like the beating pulse of the Innies. And I really appreciate the episode one for really putting that directly on point for me to understand it better.
Yeah, it's this great bit of expectation subverting in the writing. Because when you have a character that sort of, in a kind of silly, facetious way, tells you, yeah, I'm kind of the big deal around here. I'm kind of the leader. I sort of hold it all together. Like, people look to me for stability and, you know, just really help them get through the day. I mean, you could pretty much call me the person who holds things together around here. When you have somebody with that sort of dialogue, you assume they're full of shit, right?
Yes.
It's funny, right? But you also, it's funny because you assume that they're not the things that they're saying. But Dillon kind of is the things that he says. Like, he's been saying all along, I'm kind of the big dog around here. I'm kind of the leader. I'm the one that looks out for everybody and holds things together. We laugh when he says it because we think it's not true, but it is kind of true. It's this great subversion of expectations in the writing. It makes you go back now and look at those scenes and go, well, I mean, it's sort of off-putting to say those things out loud, but he's not necessarily
It's lying. Not true.
Right, exactly. So I just really... really like the writing team here. I think that they've done really good work in this show so far. I'm excited for the rest of it.
We talked about our favorite scene in episode one. Just to offer a favorite scene in episode two, the second, I very much enjoyed each of Miltrick's efforts to manipulate Mark to come back. Each of them I thought was very well played and very effective. Like the whole original of that your innie was very brave. I hate to reward his courage with non-existence was delightfully, squirmy. But yeah. The second one of when he goes to Mark's house with the one pineapple. What is it with Lumen and one pineapple, I must ask? An uncut up pineapple, too. What use is that thing? But when he goes to his house, we get that wonderful scene of where he's asking him about his wife and the intake interview and, you know, what you said that since she died, every day feels like a year, that you felt like you were choking on her ghost. Do you still feel that way, Mr. Scout? And then tying it in with how much better his innie's doing, which is what Mark always justified for why he's been going back in there, is his innie is doing better and maybe it'll bleed back to me kind of thing. That scene was both wonderful dialogue, but I loved how it was filmed, of where each shot was just a forced perspective of we get to see one person's face and we get the shadow of the other person blocking off half the camera. And they would keep cutting back to the two of them as they were filming that scene. But the dialogue, the plot purpose of it, the profoundly and perfectly manipulative effect of it, and also just the filmmaking work that was going into it, for me, that was my scene of the episode in terms of episode 2.
Yeah, that was really good. I'm trying to think. I mean, for me, it's probably the diner scene.
You talk about how much you like that diner scene for a lot of
reasons. Yeah, go ahead.
To even add on to that, I like the role that a new character for the show, Drummond, was playing into that. And focusing on the frolic tattooed on his hand, just to hammer home that this is 9/10 cult, 1/10 corporation when it comes to Lumen. That was an effective scene in a lot of different ways.
The writing team is too good to not use a word like uppity and not know the connotation. So they use that word, which I think is really driving home where they want you to be from a sort of basis of understanding of the character's perspective, like understanding the sort of emotion you attach to these characters. Throwing a word like that in is going to make you feel a certain way about Drummond, but also about Lumen. And they want to continue to drive that home that Lumen is not the good guy here. And, you know, little stuff like that does help. I like the diner scene. I almost anything with the sister really steals it for me. But driving home how little Audie Mark has progressed in his grief over a 2 to 3 year period is sort of stunning, that you're still in grief measuring. You still can't even appreciate that somebody else, you know, loved the person that you're missing. That's very early for most people. And it's not to say that, like, you know, I just want to say this, that like when I'm talking about him being late, him being stunted in his grief, mm-hmm. I don't mean to suggest like, well, after 2 weeks, you should be here. After a year, you should be here. The timelines for people are squishy, but there certainly are stages that if you stay in it for long periods of time, that it indicates something unhealthy has occurred, right? Mm-hmm. And for Mark, he's in this sort of like violent self-pity rage, and staying there for that long indicates something unhealthy. And for him, it's the fact that he doesn't have any mental space to process these things. So I don't mean to suggest like, okay, well, after 6 months, you should be over whatever. But if you aren't changing, if you aren't progressing, you aren't in a different stage and moving, then you have to ask yourself, why are you doing that? And I think they really want to drive home how like sort of unnaturally unhealthy Mark is.
Yeah.
Due to the severance, that procedure.
If anything, I would say it's not even that he's just not getting better. I think he's actively getting worse based on the life choices that he's making. Because it's not even just avoidance. He's literally cutting off half of his life, and the half that he does spend is in a vague form of a stupor. The man isn't living. So I think the show is doing a great job of emphasizing that, severance is a horrible idea for any number of reasons, but particularly the way Mark's going about living his life and using severance in it is nightmarish.
It is interesting, though. You have to give a massive shout out to Innie Mark, who has accomplished a lot. Innie Mark has accomplished a lot. And he's done it in like a stage 4 hangover the entire time. Like Audie Mark does him no favors. He shows up sleep deprived, hungover. They all know it. When he gets there, All the innies know it. They smell it on him. They see it on him. And he is able to fight through it and still accomplish quite a lot as a character.
That is no credit to Audi Mark, though. That is Innie Mark all the way. Just the extra weights that Audi Mark is putting on him to get through the day. He's running 3 miles for every one that us normal humans are.
Yeah, but then you're in this like strange spiral where you want to go to Audi Mark and shake him and say, dude, this is proof of concept of the potential you have in you. Like, you have given this massive handicap to your innie, and your innie still thrives and is crushing it down there. You have so much potential. Can you please deal with your emotions?
It is interesting to see that in every one of the characters, that each one of them feels like it is distinctly different, but perhaps just a hidden component of the Audi version that we see. That for Dylan, the Audi version that we see is struggling with confidence. He's having a hard time finding his career. He's having a hard time succeeding in the professions that he, you know, is picking for himself. Well, Innie's an all-star at every available opportunity and wants every person that he meets to know about it. Mark, utterly dealing with grief, but otherwise it's the life of the party and a beacon of happiness, potentially, when he's inside. Helena is a person able to express emotions in a way that apparently her Audi version is not, and able to make relationships and connections with other people. Irving is apparently, you know, a bit of a hermit outside and, you know, distrustful, whatever else. Meanwhile, he's a person that fully bought into the creed and is making relationships and connections when he's inside. Each of these people is seemingly profoundly different, but as you said, to what degree is it just them unwilling to connect with or recognize or express something that they're now any is able to otherwise embody?
Yeah. That'll be an interesting thing for later seasons, is when these characters start to understand each, the Audi and the Innies understand each other and get the background that we know they'll get eventually about what the other's doing, that the sort of realization of, wow, look at what I can be. This is me. It's, mm-hmm. It is me. And what I'm accomplishing if I can get out of my own way. Okay. What else do we want to cover here?
I think we've covered enough for these episodes. I was just looking at the title of the next one. I think it ties into one of your theories about where the show may be going. Title of the next episode is Who is Alive?
Who is Alive? Okay, that's exciting. We will be back with you next week to review episode 3 of Severance. Spencer, we're back. It's exciting.
Looking forward to it, man.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you all for hanging in there with us during the break, for emailing, writing in, messaging, saying you wanted to hear us in your earphones again. That's very heartwarming for both of us. We really appreciate that, and we're happy to be back, and we'll be back with you next week to review episode 3 of Severance. Everybody have a great week. See you later.